This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Germany and Greece square off today in soccer.
And oil prices fall to an 8-month low. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, June 21st. This morning, we'll talk about why Americans love small business, but apparently just hate business in general.
And what we should be comparing this economic recovery to. Is it like the 80s, like the 30s, like the 90s? We'll ask our economics correspondent. Plus, a lot of fun stuff, Jeff, including sports stories from around the globe. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with Operation Twist. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke announced yesterday he's going to expand the monetary stimulus program, which means the Fed will buy more long-term Treasury bonds.
Well, we've taken a step today, which is a substantive step, which will provide additional accommodation for the economy. And moreover, we have stated that we're prepared to take further steps, if necessary, to promote sustainable growth and recovery in the labor market.
The idea of Operation Twist is kind of an indirect way to hold down interest rates and keep up the incentives for borrowing and investment. But the economic crisis is global. Ours is not the only central bank that's worried about stoking economic growth. For the global perspective on central banking, let's bring in the BBC's Andrew Walker. He is in Luxembourg for a meeting of European finance ministers. Andrew, hello.
Hello there.
Which central banks have been the most bold and which ones have been more conservative in responding to the economic crisis?
The one that really stands out, I suppose, as being particularly bold is the Bank of England, which has been doing things that are quite similar to what the Fed has been doing, this quantitative easing, going into the markets, creating new money to buy financial assets, mainly government debt. The European Central Bank is a little bit more constrained, but it has found ways of doing this kind of thing slightly more indirectly, long-term lending to commercial banks who have then gone into the markets and used significant amounts of that money to buy the debts of the governments concerned.
And of course, there's Japan as well as a critical central bank. What challenges did they face?
Well, they have a decade or more than a decade of weak economic performance and interest rates that have been very, very low. It's had episodes of going into the markets to buy financial assets, creating more money. It has also been intervening in the foreign exchange markets to try and prevent some of the unwelcome rise in the value of the yen. But I think Japan does raise an interesting question. The limits do seem to suggest that it's not all that effective beyond a certain point, and one does wonder whether the Fed, the Bank of England, may be reaching those limits themselves.
We have a global financial crisis, but each central bank, one would think, is focused principally on what's in the best interest of their particular country, their particular market. Are the various central banks generally pulling in the same direction, or can they actually operate at cross purposes to one another?
For the most part, they have been cooperating. They've all been cutting interest rates down to very low levels in the case of Japan, the United States, and the UK. And they've also been cooperating by providing swap arrangements, as they're called, so that banks can get indirect access to any dollars that they need. That, I think, has probably prevented a much worse blow-up for some banks than might otherwise have happened.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in Luxembourg. Great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Now, the idea that 5 years after the recession began, the Fed is still taking such extraordinary action to boost the economy is pretty telling. It paints a picture of an economic recovery unlike any in recent memory. But then again, the Great Recession has been pretty unique. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now to discuss. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, what should we be comparing this recovery to?
we should be comparing it to the jobless recoveries of the early 1990s and the early 2000s. You know, you map out, you graph this recovery that we're going through to those two previous recoveries. They just look the same. Unlike the mid-70s and the early 80s, where you had much more of a rebound in the job market.
But this recession was much bigger than anything we've seen since even before the 80s, right?
That's right. But this recession has just exposed a number of ongoing trends in this economy. So, you know, businesses are really embracing productivity rather than hiring workers. You know, let's get more out of our people before we hire more.
Yeah, really.
And you got the information technologies, and those have wiped out whole departments of low-level white-collar workers. And then, of course, there's globalization. So, Jeremy, if you look at a lot of these companies, you know, the S&P 500 companies, the ones that we talk about all the time, they're hiring. They are hiring, but much of the hiring is going on overseas.
Well, so does that mean that every recovery we're going to see now going forward is going to be a jobless recovery in the United States?
I think that needs to be our expectation. And here's the thing. What that tells us is during a recovery, during the good times, okay, we can't exactly call what we're going through right now the good times, but let's assume that we do have good times. You know, we need to focus a lot more on training programs, on working with the less skilled, the less educated workers, because these are the ones that are really being hammered during this period of time. And so there's really a lesson for the recoveries. Where do we invest our dollars, as opposed to a lesson from the downturn?
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, it's time now for a little attitude check.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Attitude Check is our weekly partnership with Gallup. And here, as always, is Gallup's editor-in-chief, Frank Newport. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So Gallup's been asking Americans about our confidence in various institutions. And at the very top is the military. No big surprise there. In second place, small business. And this is where it gets interesting. Way down near the bottom, big business. Why do you think Americans have so much more love for small business compared to the big variety?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and it's a huge difference. It's about 42 points on our rating scale of confidence with just that one word, small versus big. We also know the same thing happens in terms of government. We like our local government, and we're very distrustful about the federal government on a relative basis. Why that's the case, we don't know for sure. We just know that historically, Americans think small is great. So the advice to big business CEOs listening right now is make your business appear small. How's that for advice?
Well, according to the Small Business Administration, for example, a small business has up to 500 or even 1,500 employees, depending on the sector. What do you think Americans think small means in this context anyway?
I think they're thinking of the grocery store on the corner or the dry cleaner, the hardware store. You know, one anomaly here is that Americans really love the computer industry. When we do separate rankings of industry sectors, that's at the top. And, of course, a lot of the computer companies are huge these days, mm-hmm. like Facebook and Apple and Microsoft. But maybe when people think of those, they're thinking of Steve Jobs in his garage or Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room at Harvard, and they still think of those as small, even though they're huge.
Since you raised that question of industries, what kind of sectors do Americans dislike?
Oil and gas is at the bottom, along with, I should say, the federal government, which is dead last. So you've got the computer industry at the top, oil and gas at the bottom, yet the valuation, at least, of Apple has been as big or bigger than the ExxonMobil or some other companies. They're seen as big. Computer companies, hey, they're small and we like them.
If they can make themselves look like a small mom-and-pop oil and gas companies, maybe then they're onto something.
Yeah, I had the thought that maybe the gas company should emphasize the gas stations on the corner, right? Look
sure.
how small we are, and that's what they should put in their ads.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you, Frank. And actually, stay with us. I'm going to hand you over to Jeremy to take on a whole different topic with you.
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
Well, how do Americans feel overall about what the Obama administration did on immigration last week?
Taken in isolation, every bit of data I've seen show Americans approve. We had asked about something similar, the so-called DREAM Act, a few months ago, and a majority of Americans approved. There was at least one poll done by Bloomberg News, which has been conducted since his announcement. They tried to list exactly what the Obama administration put forth last Friday, and they found, too, a significant majority of Americans approved of it. So in and of itself, Americans think that's a good idea not to deport these young people, these young children of illegal immigrants, if they meet certain requirements.
What about Hispanic voters in particular? Is there any difference there?
Well, you know, the polls don't have enough sample of Hispanic voters in a typical smaller poll like that to be able to isolate. So the assumption is Hispanic voters would be positive about what the Obama administration did, but we don't have large enough samples to be able to isolate that precisely.
Well, then do we know about one of the things that Republicans in particular have been talking about, which is that Hispanic voters don't vote on single issues, that they are interested in the economy just like everybody else?
That's absolutely correct. Keep in mind that you have to be a registered voter to vote, and registered voter Hispanics are a significantly small percent of the overall Hispanic population. And although immigration issues are important, some new research that we're doing shows that registered voters who are Hispanics are just as interested in many of the economic issues that concern everybody else as they are on immigration issues specifically.
Well, let me ask you about one more thing, Frank. There's been a lot of buzz as this immigration story has played out about Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, and whether maybe Mitt Romney will put him on the ticket as the vice president. What do we know about voter attitudes towards him?
We know that a lot of voters have no attitudes towards Senator Rubio because they've never heard of him. You know, we asked our classic name ID question just a bit ago, and over half of Americans scratched their head and said, "Who?" Of those Americans who do know him enough to give an opinion, a little over 4 out of 10 can give an opinion of Marco Rubio. The attitudes were somewhat more positive than negative, but already partisan. He's already seen, for those who know him, as a partisan in the sense that Republicans really like him and Democrats have a net negative impression of the young man. He's only in his young 40s. Democrats already have a negative impression of him even before he's really burst onto the national stage.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
Well, Jeff, there is a train station worker in the United Kingdom named Colin Miller who helps make sure commuters board the trains on time every morning. He stands on the platform and helps get them on board.
Very important job.
Absolutely. And he just happens to look exactly like the late Italian opera singer Luciano Pavarotti.
A big guy.
So, of course, he has started singing for the commuters.
Quali de stelle.
Sounds just like him, doesn't he, Jeff?
I guess if you stuck Luciano Pavarotti in a subway station, what it would sound like. I got kind of a transit story for you here, too.
All right.
It takes a little bit more of a sad note, but also happy. We love numbers on the show, and here's a number to start with. $150,000. That is how much money strangers on the internet raised for a 68-year-old woman named Karen Klein. Now, Karen is a school bus monitor for a middle school in Greece, New York, in upstate New York. Basically, she just sort of sits there. She's supposed to monitor their behavior, right? But here is how those kids treat her. And this is in a video that one of the kids put on YouTube, and it's titled, Making the Bus Monitor Cry.
Karen, you're fat.
You take up, like, the whole
JC. Oh, no. What the
oh, my God.
So that's the tiniest snippet that we could actually play. It gets vulgar. It's horrible. It goes on for 10 minutes. They poke her. They call her a troll. So this thing went viral, Jeremy. And just yesterday, a man in Toronto set up a fundraiser on the site Indiegogo to send Karen on a vacation. This is an idea. Raise a little money, $1,500, send her on vacation. Well, that's going to be one hell of a vacation because I looked at the site a minute ago, and it's over $150,000.
Wow. Good. Good. All right. Justice has been done.
Indeed.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Tonight could be the last game of the NBA Finals. The Miami Heat lead the Oklahoma City Thunder 3-1, which means one more win for Miami and they get the championship. Now, wait till you hear how much people are going to have to shell out for tickets. From station WLRN in Miami, here's Kenny Malone.
All right, how you doing, sir?
Hey, how you going?
Bo Irwin is from Manchester, England. He's 25 years old and just happens to be in town for arguably the biggest basketball game in Miami history. So he popped his head into Tickets of America, a ticket broker down the street from the Heat's arena.
I just want to know how much they're going to be on Thursday.
All right, so we've got a couple different options for you, all starting around the $500 range.
A little too much for Bo Irwin.
Okay, yeah, I'll just have a little think and then I'll come back.
Here's my card.
Okay, cool.
Prices for this Game 5 have gotten as high as $25,000 for a courtside seat. But maybe fans should be more concerned with the future.
In years past, many ownerships have decided to raise their ticket prices after a championship has been won.
Ann-Britt Stengel runs Sports Traveler, a sports-centric travel agency in Chicago.
Because they do also know that the demand of their ticket is going up, and the demand on their season ticket usually goes up also.
Stengel says there's no formula for how much tickets go up, but she says you'll want to get your tickets for the Heat season opener as early as possible. Everyone wants to be there when the champions get their rings. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we got another Euro clash between Germany and Greece, but this time it's not economics, it's soccer. The two face each other in the Euro 2012 quarterfinals. At least this meeting is not about debt, bailouts, austerity, and all that dull and boring stuff. Or is it? Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Relations between the two nations have soured over the debt crisis, so perhaps this soccer match can heal the rift. Forget it, says Rogan Taylor, a soccer expert at Liverpool University.
No, football isn't about bringing people together and love and peace and all that stuff. It's about showing who's in charge.
Right now, that's Germany in soccer and finance. The Germans dominate the Eurozone economy, and they've been crushing opposition on the soccer field too. And that, Rogan says, is why humiliated Greeks will be desperate for victory and revenge.
As if this, at least for a moment, restores every sense of national pride and respect.
The two sides used to play very differently. The Germans were methodical and organised, the Greeks more spontaneous, even volatile. But international coaching has brought the two styles closer together. The two teams have changed in a way that economists say the two countries must change, the Germans becoming more Greek and the Greeks becoming more German.
Football, as always, pointing towards some kind of resolution.
At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Let's keep talking sports for today's Midday Extra, specifically the new track and field uniforms for this year's Olympic Games. They were recently unveiled by Nike, and the big selling point is that they're expected to shave 0.02 of a second off of 100-meter sprint times compared to the suits in Beijing. So is that investment really worth getting a hair faster?
Here to talk about the new track suits, can we call them track suits, is Paul Hawkman. He's gear and technology editor for the NBC Today show, and he's covered the last four Olympics. Hello, Paul.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So this goes on all the time with all kinds of different Olympic gear. Swimming is one we heard about a lot with the last Olympics. What kind of development process does something like this go through?
First of all, it's ongoing, and it's years. I'd say it's 2,500 years. And ever since the first Olympics in Athens, there has been a fine line between people who are saying they have an unfair advantage and people who are saying, well, what's an unfair advantage? We want to win. The stakes are enormous. So developments since the beginning of the Olympics have been going on in terms of developing technology that help athletes move more quickly and so on. But the stuff we're talking about now, Nike's what they call their pro turbo speed suit for their track team, has been going on actually for probably 15 years in development, but the most recent iteration has been probably just before the Olympics began in Beijing 4 years ago.
Isn't working out a little more or, you know, having the right dinner the night before going to get you a better result than shaving off 1/1000th or 2/1000th of a second on a sprint time by buying this fancy suit?
Well, there's no buying involved. None of the athletes actually have to pay for it. But the short answer is no. Absolutely every single component of an athlete's performance, whether it's the uniform they wear, the shoes on their feet, or their workout and their diet, everything is scrutinized now. It's down literally, you said 2/1000, it's actually 23/1000 of a second.
Wow.
So 0.02 plus 0.03 is shaved off or claimed to be shaved off at its maximum by the Nike, the new Nike suit. That's actually enormous. 0.02 separates, in many cases, sometimes 2 or 3 sprint athletes if they come across the line. So every single piece of an athlete's performance is scrutinized so carefully by engineers and trainers and so forth that, no, I would say that nothing matters more or less. It all matters.
So these uniforms are also, they're green, quote-unquote, I guess, made from recycled plastic, which it just seems a little gratuitous to me. But what is in it for a company like Nike to put all this time and energy into these suits?
The payoff is that the athletes are performing on arguably the most prominent marketing stage of any event in the world, which is the Olympics. Every little inch of real estate on the athlete's body is coveted by every company out there that makes athletic gear, in part because people who are watching want to emulate their heroes or heroines, but also because everybody's watching, they'll remember the brands. Yes, it is true that many of these technologies don't work out, but I'll tell you what. On the screen of the literally billions of televisions that are displaying the Olympic Games, even if a suit, say a swimsuit, doesn't end up on the podium, if it's on the athlete as they're about to dive in, then an enormous marketing victory has just been had even before the race has begun. So any green message, any fast message, anything that says this provides advantage is something that people who watch are really excited about. So it's certainly not a bad thing for Nike to be associated not only with speed, but with green performance as well.
Well, what do you think we should look out for technology-wise coming up for London 2012?
Lawyers. in other words, what you should be looking for is a lot of athletes and coaches complaining that somebody has an unfair advantage when it comes to some of these suits. I mean, in the last Olympics, Speedo made tons of news because their laser racer suit was called technological doping by the Italian swim coach, who, by the way, was jealous because he didn't have the suits. By the way, it's not uncommon that these things will end up in dispute. So if you're watching the games, watch not only for contoured suits that have dimples on them like golf balls, which Nike's does, new shoes that actually are built like suspension bridges so that they're customized for the athlete but weigh almost nothing. They're made of threads that are stronger than steel. But also conflict is what the sports are all about. Watch for the conflict both on the track and potentially in the courtroom.
Paul Hochman is gear and technology editor for the NBC Today Show. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For economists, stimulus can come from Washington, like the little bit of it we got yesterday from the Federal Reserve. For the rest of us, it can come from a lower price at the pump. As Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports, that is exactly what is happening right now.
Ben Bernanke is a former professor, an Ivy Leaguer who speaks quietly. But he bristles if you suggest that the Federal Reserve is out of ammunition.
I do think that monetary policy still does have some capacity to strengthen the economy by easing financial conditions.
In the nerdy world of economics, that's a declaration of war. On the other side of the battleground are economists like Steve Hanke at Johns Hopkins, who say that Bernanke is fighting a losing battle.
The portion of the total money supply that the Fed really accounts for is now about 15%. About 85% is produced by private banking system. And what's going on, the private banks aren't loaning much money. They're contracting.
No matter how powerful Bernanke's weapons, they can't fight a global recession. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
We have a little bit of an exclusive here this morning. I'm going to share that with you now. Abram Lustgarten is a reporter with ProPublica, and he's here to talk with me about a new investigation he has out this morning suggesting that the common way oil and gas and other industries dispose of waste underground, apparently tons of industries do this, may be a lot less safe than we thought. Abram, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
First, tell us about these underground injection waste wells. Who uses them? And what are they supposedly good for?
Well, there's a couple different kinds, but basically everybody uses them, from the pharmaceutical and the chemical manufacturing industry to the oil and gas industries to your neighborhood gas station. And they basically dump waste to varying depths underground, out of sight, out of mind. The most toxic contaminants are put deep underground, anywhere between 1,500 feet and 10,000 feet underground.
And what's the reason that we take this waste and put it so far underground?
Well, the thinking is that it gets buried deeply below layers of rock that provide a seal forever. One of the thresholds, regulatory thresholds, is that fluids will stay there for 10,000 years. So the waste goes down into porous layers of rock or aquifers that are never going to be used for drinking water supplies and just basically stays trapped down there forever, that we never hope to see it again.
The upshot of your investigation is that many of these wells may be leaking and we might not even know about it. If they leak, what happens?
Well, it's not entirely clear what happens. There's an example that I explore in southern Ohio where a hazardous waste well did leak, and it took 20 years for the contaminants to move up through the rock about 1,400 feet. And that's the point where researchers had been investigating what had happened with that well. The question is, how long does it take those contaminants to continue to move? Will they continue to move? But if they were to get into people's water supplies, then it would ruin that water supply. But the challenge is, how do people know it? Will they taste it? Will it be detected in some other way?
If, in fact, we cannot rely on injection waste wells like we thought we could, what are the implications for industry?
Well, it's huge. It's the most important way to dispose of liquid waste. The consensus may still be that that this is the best alternative that we face. We just perhaps need to evaluate the risks, understand what those risks might be better. Recycling is an alternative that's more expensive. Producing less waste is the thing that sources tell me should be our ultimate goal, with the threats of waste disposal in mind, the greater cost, perhaps it's worth the effort to simply produce less material that needs to be put underground.
Abram Lustgarten with ProPublica, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jeff, you are in Los Angeles. I am in New York, and today it is extremely hot here.
How hot is it?
Yeah, it's probably nearing 100 degrees, I think. It's extremely hot.
Oh, man.
And thanks to that, and also a closure of a factory in Maryland, a calamity has occurred.
A calamity.
Terrible disaster.
That sounds horrible.
There is a shortage of Good Humor's classic toasted almond chocolate eclair ice cream bars.
No.
In the Northeast, which is apparently a big favorite in the Northeast. The company says the issue should be resolved by the end of July, which is a long time away. And in the meantime, customers will be forced to choose from Good Humor's 21 other ice cream products.
21. That's a good number. Here's some more numbers to throw at you before we wrap up here. 3,200. That is the number of people who live on Hawaii's sixth biggest island. It's called Lanai. So Oracle CEO Larry Ellison, he's buying Lanai. He's buying the island, the sixth biggest island in Hawaii, or 98% of it anyway, which includes a lot of residential and apartment buildings. I just find that so interesting that they live there. It's just being bought, I suppose, like any other residential property. Of course, it's, you know, however many beautiful, beautiful acres to be developed. And I guess it's just time for those Lanai residents to, all they got to do really is just change the address on their rent checks.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, when I saw that he was going to buy 98% of Lanai, whether that would be enough to park his 453-foot yacht.
It's certainly enough to sail the yacht around many, many times. So Larry Ellison's playground in Hawaii is expanding.
Well, we ought to go take the podcast on the road and check it out for ourselves in Lanai sometime. I think that'd be fun.
Let's do it on location. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.